Welcome to Strong Tower Radio Today. The views and opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of Strong Tower Radio, West Central Michigan Media Ministries, or its employees.
Hi, folks. I'm Jillian Fenner, and welcome back to Strong Tower Radio Today with my co-host,
Tom Measure.
And we have Gary Heilig. Hi, Gary.
Hi, how's everything going?
Good, and he is our garden guy.
It's always good when we have the garden guy.
That's
here.
Right, Tom. This is Tom's favorite program. And we're in the month of October, so we're going to have a variety of topics. And we have a first. But before we get started this program, Tom, have a word of prayer.
We will. We're going to leave a little anticipation here.
Yes.
Our Father in heaven, we always enjoy coming to you as a personal friend, and you walked with Adam and Eve, and when we're down in the garden and we're working that soil, I think you're there with us. Mm-hmm. Be with us as we learn more to be better gardeners and to be a partner with you. In Jesus' name, amen.
So I said we have a first. What we have a caller on the phone that's going to ask Gary a question. And Tom, why don't you introduce this caller?
Well, I've known this the caller all her life. It happens to be my baby sister. And what makes it very interesting is you've been hearing her questions all along, except she's just been feeding them through me to Gary.
Yeah.
And I kind of call her the armchair gardener. She reads the books and tells me what to do.
And her name is?
Her name happens to be Sue Measure. So she's Kazoo Sue from Kalamazoo.
Okay.
And so, Sue, why don't you ask your question to the garden guy, Gary Heilig.
Well, hey there, garden guy. I know somebody who's putting up a greenhouse, and I was wondering, can they plant dwarf fruit trees in there? Is the fall an appropriate time of year? And will the bees pollinate them so they can get a good crop?
It can be done. MSU has been doing some research with dwarf sweet cherries in greenhouses, so it can be done. Now, it's not really necessary for apples or pears, but the reason they do it for cherries is because when it rains, when the cherries are ready to be harvested, they can split if they get too much water. So that's why they've been doing that. Now, native bees or honeybees don't really like going inside greenhouses, so you might have to use bumblebees for pollination. But, yeah, you can grow anything in a greenhouse.
Great question, Sue.
And you can plant them now if you can get the trees.
So, Sue, thank you very much for being the inaugural caller on the Garden Guy Show.
Thank you, Sue.
We
appreciate your call in. All right. You take care.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
So, folks, That was a first, and we maybe will work that out again. But if you have any questions for the garden guy, please email them to tom@strongtowerradio.org. And in case you can't get online or send an email, you can always call us at 877-278-5512 and ask to talk to Tom.
Yep. I'll be there.
And if he is not here, you can leave your question with Sandy or Chris, whoever may answer, and they will give it to Tom. So make sure you give us your question and your name and number so we can get back with you, Gary can get back with you.
And you may want to make it month appropriate. We're working on November and December next. So start storing up your November, December, and call Tom at strongtowerradio.org.
So the month of October, Gary, we're talking about, okay, we've harvested almost everything probably out of our garden. We need to think about evaluating it, what we'll do next year. Is that it?
Yeah. What I like to do is I try different varieties every year, and I keep a little record about which ones perform well and which one were dogs. And
I had a few dogs this year. So.
Yeah, I remember a tomato called Mortgage Lifter. I think I might have mentioned this.
Yes, you did.
In an earlier program, and I really wanted to try it, and I tried it, and I just was so unimpressed. So those things happen. And you can start making your plans for the following year. You can get your orders in early if you want to. Also, you might want to think about getting your soil tested. If you're doing any soil building, bringing in organic matter, starting compost piles, all those things should be done in the later part of the season. So I think it's always good if you want to be a successful gardener to look back on the mistakes that you made, what you could have done differently, what you could improve upon, and it gives you the opportunity to try something new the following year.
Now, Gary, we were talking off mic here, and you said we're doing the October show, that you were starting to get a little depressed. So is there a gardener depression, seasonal depression?
Well, yeah, there is, mm-hmm. because after you've had that first killing frost and everything is brown, sometimes you'll see me standing in the middle of the garden with my head hanging low. It's just that, you know, everything's going to be asleep for a while, but you can move indoors because there's lots of indoor things that you can do.
Well, and I think that you need to get the whole series of the Garden Guy shows and listening to mm-hmm. the other months throughout the year.
Right.
Actually, we were talking about that we might start a series with the Garden Guy mm-hmm. sometime in the future.
Well, and he does have a YouTube channel, and it's Gary Heilig, H-E-I-L-I-G. And he, right now there's about 82, as of this recording, YouTube videos he has, but he's going to be working.
Yeah, my goal is to have 100 up by the end of the year.
Okay.
But one of the things I was looking at is the analytics the other day, and I noticed that 85% of the audience were men.
That's amazing.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things I want to do is I'm going to do some surveying of classes that I teach this fall, Master Gardener classes, and also sending some surveys to Michigan garden clubs to find out what topics women would like to hear about.
So okay. you're going to have gender parity?
Yeah, if you want to call it that. I just want to make sure I have the widest audience possible. And there are some differences between guys and ladies in terms of what their main interests are. So
a guy may put different plants, varieties of plants or vegetables or fruits?
Well, for instance, my specialty when I was teaching in horticulture or extension was fruit and vegetable production. And so I started out putting up a lot of stuff about managing home orchards. Well, that's mainly what the guys do.
Mm.
And so I want to try to expand the audience by finding out what some things are that women would be interested in hearing about.
Well, you mentioned that you taught classes. You're still teaching classes?
Oh, yeah. I still teach Master Gardener classes in the spring and the fall for MSU. And then I get requests for different things every now and then.
If people literally want to not only hear you on radio, but want to sit under your tutelage, see you in person, well, how would they?
There's not that much to see.
But well, they want to go to one of your classes.
Well, the Master Gardener program, they always list on MSU's website where they are in the state. And also, you need to talk to that county to see if I'm teaching that year in that particular county. But also, I do, our church offers, and when I say our church, I'm talking about the denomination, offers health club teaching, supper clubs, they call them a lot of times. And I get requests to do those every now and then in different places.
So that was a question I was going to ask you. You will go do seminars.
Yeah.
Okay.
I do seminars different places. I will teach for garden clubs when I get requests.
Do you ever do any programs for kids in gardening?
I have done programs from everything preschool up into 80s and 90s. Mm. So I've worked with all ages.
Okay. Amen.
So even with people that have disabilities and
yep,
such?
Everything. Okay. I don't think there's an audience that I haven't taught something for.
Well, that's good. Well, we are so fortunate to have Gary. We
Absolutely.
Are just so glad that
my mind is turning. I am the program producer for Purdue Production. So, Gary, there are some things that are working in my mind here.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about, so you want to bring in house plants because, I'm thinking one thing like a spider plant, you grow it year-round, but it's nice to get it outside during the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to grow a little faster, a little, I don't know, more fuller when it's outside in the fresh air and sunshine.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't leave it or it'll die. So you got to bring it in.
That's right. And I traditionally do this with my plants. I'll take them outside around late May so that I'm not likely to have them frosted. Mm. And they'll come in about early October, depending on what type of tree it is or shrub or whatever it might be that I'm trying to grow indoors and outdoors. One of my favorites is I have a date palm that I started from seed.
Really?
And it's usually outside during the summer. And it's about a foot high now. It's so about 2 years old.
Are you getting dates?
Oh, no. It'll be a while before that happens.
I wondered. Okay.
But eventually I might. It'll be more of a dwarf tree because it is in a small container. But when you bring plants inside, you also bring insects inside. And insects have no predators indoors. So what can happen is their populations, like aphids, can explode in a very short period of time or scale. So it's important that you check the plants over. And if they have anything like mites or scale or aphids, those things are treated before bringing them in so that you don't have a problem later. You also will have other little things. I brought in tree frogs.
Oh, my.
You just put those back outside.
Well, don't you enjoy them, you know, croaking or whatever they do?
Well, they're pretty quiet. You just happen to see them sitting on the window or something one day. And you'll bring in things like millipedes, centipedes, sow bugs, sometimes ants. So you may have some things that'll come in with the plants. And those I don't worry too much about. I just, you know, get them out. They don't survive very well indoors and they die. I just vacuum those up.
So tell me which plants you didn't take out in the spring.
Did not take out. Oh, I have, I didn't take all of my pineapples out. I still have some under lights in the basement. And, excuse me, I have a fairly large philodendron that I don't want to move. It's so big now.
Oh, okay. Size.
The leaves are bigger than your entire abdomen.
Wow.
I mean, it's huge. And so if I would have had that outside, the leaves would have probably been a size larger again. So
it would be tropical, huh?
Yeah, they can get very large in the jungle. So, and then I have a tangelo tree that's still in the basement, but it has scale on it that needs to be treated, and it just hasn't been doing very well. So I don't know if I'll keep it. But everything else usually goes outside.
Okay, so we're talking about, you know, evaluating our garden, bringing in, you know, houseplants. So this is the time we need to clean up the garden.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
And a lot of people think, well, why should I bother? I'll just let it all rot in place. Well, for instance, if you had a squash vine borer problem this year, what happens is that squash vine borer will go out of the plant and into the soil. And they like to be at a certain depth for survivability. And one of the things I do after I clean up the garden is I will till the garden. And so that will disrupt where they are, and it increases the chance they won't survive during the winter. Or if you can get the garden cleaned up earlier, you can decrease the amount of possibility of getting certain diseases because you've taken all those disease materials out and composted them. Sometimes what I'll do is just dig large holes and bury things in place, and that takes care of the disease issues. I live out in the country, so we will use a lot of straw. And if I have too much straw and I don't want to compost it, I'll just set it on fire.
Mm-hmm.
And what that will do is I always have some remnants from tomato plants that have diseases, and it burns that up too. So I decrease the chances of getting those diseases the following year. I try to get all strings out. I get the tomato cages stacked up. We pull up the landscape fabric and clean that off and roll it up for the next year. So sometimes I'll spread a little nitrogen if I want to speed up the decomposition of materials that I've turned under in the soil. And so I start out with a nice clean garden in spring that I don't have to clean up. And it does benefit the plants in terms of decreasing chances of disease.
Okay. What about collecting, saving, and storing seed?
That's a good question. I like that one.
Well, I always like to play around with things. When I order a perennial, for instance, that I can't buy seeds for, I will collect seeds from that perennial. They usually have to go through a cold treatment, and then I'll try to germinate them just so I have more of those plants. And if you're going to collect seeds, whether it's vegetables or flowers or whatever, you want to collect it from a superior plant. And for instance, if I was collecting jalapeno seeds, if it's a hybrid, it's not really a good idea to keep hybrid seeds because they start to revert back to the parent plants and they're not going to come true. But if you have something that's open pollinated, like some of the old green bean heirloom varieties, for instance, open pollinated means you can collect the seeds from those plants and they will be true to what they were the year before. So that will save you some money.
Yeah, we've collected, you know, marigold seeds and stuff like mm-hmm. that, but nothing serious like this.
Yeah.
You know, we've relied totally on the seed companies and pay the prices for that.
Yeah.
Do all seed collecting, is it done the same way, or do different plants you extract the seeds differently?
Well, the big thing you want to be sure is that the seed is mature. And so I wait till the plant dies before I collect the seeds. And then once I collect the seeds, and like I said, you want to collect it from a good quality, superior plant, then I take those seeds in and put them on some newspaper or something so that they can dry out. If you put moist new seed in, say, a plastic bag, it's going to mold and it's not going to be any good. So you want those dry and then you keep them cool. And people collect seeds for a number of different reasons. One, you can save money. Now, my wife will actually keep zinnia seeds even from the hybrids. They don't look like the hybrids the following season. They're inferior, but she's happy with it. So she will collect all those things, and it saves a lot of money. And it's fun. It's fun to try new things. And some things might be of interest to children because pumpkins will cross with acorn squash. So really? Cucurbits that are closely related will cross, and some of the squashes will cross. So you could save some of those seeds, plant them, and see what comes up the next year.
Surprise.
Oh. Yeah. Because it might be a pumpkin or it might be an acorn.
It could be a cross between a pumpkin and an acorn, or a cross between a Hubbard and something else.
Oh,
and
interesting.
As long as they're closely related, they can cross.
You know, we talked about in September's program about the garden clubs. Do garden clubs save seeds? Or do those seeds
not
save?
Not as a club, but individuals probably do to some extent.
And then seed saving has become quite active with the concern about GMOs and so on and so forth. Is there a renaissance in seed saving?
Well, when you talk about seed saving and GMOs, you don't have to worry about that in vegetable gardens because we just don't have a lot of GMOs available to homeowners. GMO means is genetically modified. Well, every seed that you buy that is a hybrid is genetically modified. It's just the way that it's being done that's different. But you don't have to worry about your seeds being contaminated by somebody growing GMOs because most likely they have the same seeds that you do and they're not GMOs. They are working on some GMO vegetable seeds. They would be available to commercial people first. Whether or not they would be available to homeowners would be dependent upon whether they would accept them. But for instance, the kind of things you would see in a vegetable garden would be BT sweet corn, which would be a sweet corn that produces an endotoxin that's naturally found in the Bacillus bacteria, which whenever you would get some of the corn pests feeding on it, they would automatically die without you having to spray the BT on it, even though BT is an organic product. They're working on squash where they're more virus resistant and things of that sort. But homeowners don't have access to that stuff right now.
Okay, well, we need to take a break. But I want to ask you about Creeping Charlie. Like, what is it? So we'll be right back, folks. You want to find out what this is? Stay tuned. We'll be right back with the Garden Guy.
The Bible and God's character are under attack like never before. Here at Strong Tower Radio, we are proud to hold up the Bible as a lamp unto our feet and a light unto our path. We believe the Bible is the Word of God and contains the good news of God's character and His great plan of salvation for mankind. If you know and believe this to be true, Won't you help Strong Tower Radio proclaim the truth about our God and His Word, the Bible? To do that, go to www.strongtowerradio.org, and there, on our secure website, you will find a donate button. Click on that and give as the Lord directs. Thank you for listening and supporting Strong Tower Radio, where God's character is proclaimed.
Hi, folks. Welcome back to Strong Tower Radio today. I'm one of your co-hosts, Jelaine Fenner.
And Tom Majeure.
And we are with our garden guy, Gary Heilig.
Yes, I'm still here.
Okay. And we're in the month of October.
We'd be in trouble if you weren't here.
Yes. And we have lots of questions. I just had said something before we ran out of time about Creeping Charlie. So you want to tell us, what is that?
Creeping Charlie is a lawn weed that causes a lot of consternation because as it spreads, it will basically take over the grass, and the grass will die out there. And it's also called ground ivy. It has a little purple flower, and the leaves are different in that the edges are rounded, a series of little half circles all the way around the edge of the leaf. And it's very hard to get rid of. It's resistant to a lot of chemicals. Mm-hmm. But October is the ideal time to control it. And there is a product that has a chemical called triclopyr in it. And that's T-R-I-C-L-O-P-Y-R. And if you were to buy a Weed Be Gone product, it's something like Weed Be Gone, Oxalis Clover, and something else killer. We call it Weed Be Gone Purple because the label's kind of purple. And on a nice sunny day in early October, you go out and spray this material on it and then walk away and just laugh because in the spring it'll be gone.
Really?
Wonderful.
But any other time, you're going to have a difficult time killing it.
So this Creeping Charlie, ground ivy that overtakes the lawn, It's in October is the best time to get rid of it.
Best time to get it. A nice sunny day in early October, like the first or second week.
Okay. And what's the product?
It's called Weed Be Gone, Oxalis Clover, and something else killer.
Okay.
And
you spray it?
You mix it with water and you spray it on the plants and let it go. Just be sure that you don't spray it just before rain. You don't want it to wash off. You want it to dry on the plant. And it does a good job. I've used it. Now, you do have to watch the area because if it's produced seeds, it'll come back the following year. Mm-hmm. But you can stop it from moving through your lawn by doing that treatment in October.
Okay. All right. Well, now let's talk about composting. What to compost, why to compost, why wouldn't you compost?
Well, composting is basically nature lets things compost anyway. It starts to break down and returns to its basic components. But adding compost to your garden or your flower beds or planters or whatever really will improve the quality of the plants because you're adding organic matter. Organic matter has the ability to hold and release nutrients for the plants so they don't wash down through the soil. It acts as a sponge, which means when it's really warm during the summer, it holds water for longer periods of time. And a healthier plant is one that's less likely to have problems with the diseases and insects. So I try not to waste organic matter and ship it off like people like to rake up their leaves and send them to the landfill. So I like to compost things right where they are. And you can compost things that you cut out of the garden, food from the kitchen, and we're talking primarily fruit and vegetable materials. You don't want to compost prepared foods that have oils and meats and things like that in them because those types of things, even though they can be composted, they have to be composted the right way. And what I mean by that is these things would have to be buried deep in the soil, like 18 inches, so that rodents won't get to them. And depending on where you live, that might be prohibited in terms of putting it in a compost pile. Otherwise, you can get fines.
So you, when you dig your 18-inch, probably 24-inch hole, that you throw the dirt over it immediately. Does it have to be fully buried, all of the 18, or just enough to?
It should be all the way up to the surface. So what? If I was doing something like spaghetti or something like that that has oils or meat products in them, you want to put them down 24 inches and completely bury it. And it'll break down and it won't smell. But if you were to have a surface compost pile where people are putting leaves and grass clippings in it, and you put that stuff on top of the pile, it's going to attract rats and skunks and raccoons and various other things that you don't want around the yard.
Very good. Very good.
So are those the only methods for composting?
Well, when people build piles, we have what we call the slow pile, which is I'm just putting organic matter here and it breaks down, and once it breaks down, I'll use it. Or there are things that we can do to speed up that process. And one of the things that you can do is chop up materials, like what your lawnmower might do, you know, chopping up leaves before putting in a compost pile. Having the right high carbon to high nitrogen materials, roughly what we want is 2 times as much high carbon material as we do high nitrogen. And an example of high carbon materials might be things like leaves, for instance, or old vegetable matter. High nitrogen materials would be things like grass clippings or fresh vegetable matter that is coming right out of the kitchen. And so by having that right carbon to nitrogen ratio, things will break down faster because bacteria need these things in certain proportions in order for them to be most effective. Also, a compost pile needs to be moist in order for it to break down quickly. So when it dries out, it's going to be inactive. And it has to be a certain size. If it's not at least 3 feet by 3 feet by 3 feet, all the heat that the bacteria produce, which encourages other bacteria, will just dissipate into the atmosphere.
It's not concentrated enough?
It's not, because there's a series of bacteria that move into the pile. There's a saprophytic bacteria, the mesophytic, and the thermophilic bacteria. And the thermophilic bacteria don't even come into the pile until it exceeds 100 degrees.
So if you have enough concentration, you'll never get to that point.
Well, it won't break down as fast. It'll break down, but it just won't go as fast. The thermophilic bacteria, when they work, if you've ever seen a compost pile drop within just a couple of days, that's because the thermophilic bacteria have been working that fast and cause things to break down. Whereas the saprophytic bacteria can work at very low temperatures, like 32 degrees. They're still working, but they're not doing it really quickly.
So what about when you have these compost piles? It kind of can smell bad.
Not if you manage them right.
Okay.
What we want with a compost pile is what we call an aerobic pile, which means you're doing things to encourage oxygen-loving bacteria to break down the pile. And it basically just smells like soil. Now, if, for instance, it gets too wet or you put too much nitrogen in it, things start to happen. Like too much nitrogen, you start get ammonia production.
And that's too much fresh stuff.
Yeah, too much high nitrogen material, like too much grass. And so it starts to produce ammonia, which you don't like that smell. Or you might get the smell of sulfur dioxide, like what you would smell if you opened up a septic tank. These are what we call anaerobic bacteria. They're the ones that don't need oxygen in order to carry out the process of breaking down material. And although they're very effective in doing it, it's just that they give off these odors that people find objectionable. So you want to keep it aerobic. And the way you do that is, if you're going to be real anal about it, you'd use a thermometer, a composting thermometer. Once the pile drops below 100 degrees, you turn it. And then after a while, it won't go back much over 100 degrees. But by turning it and introducing oxygen into the pile, it'll break down faster and it stays aerobic, or in other words, it won't stink.
And where do we get this temperature gauge?
Oh, you can go online. They're basically thermometers that have a very long
shaft
on them. Yeah. So you can for a big pile.
Drive it down in the pile.
You can get them as little as $20, but if you buy the $20 ones, don't drop it. And then you can get the really good forestry type jobbies. They're about $75, $80. You can drop that multiple times and they will still work. So you get what you pay for.
So, you know, what can you put in the pile? What shouldn't you put in the pile, maybe?
Well, most people will put things like leaves, fresh vegetable matter, but I tend to like to bury that onto the inside of the pile. Grass clippings, even if the grass clippings have been treated with a material for weed control, by the time the compost is ready, it would have broken down. Now, I would not put anything from meat-eating animals in there, like animal manures. You want to avoid putting stuff from bird cages in there because some birds can have certain diseases that can cause a problem for human beings. Sawdust can go in there as long as it's not treated lumber, sawdust. So there are lots of things that you can compost.
My wife likes to run out to the compost pile about once a day. So I have a feeling that we're going to have to modify our practice to have optimized. So we probably need to put it in a container, kind of store it up a little bit, and then take it out. So it's worth, I don't think she'll want to, or probably me too, probably want to turn over, when you just want to get rid of a you know, bunch of husks from the corn, you don't want to go through all this.
No, those can just go on the top of the pile.
Okay, that can.
I'm talking about foods that might attract something. Well, you know, like if you, apple peels, for instance, they're sweet and it will attract certain animals. But if you dig a hole and put it in the middle of the pile, they won't.
So
I mean, as long as it's down deep enough.
The parts of the broccoli or anything that stems.
Yeah,
and
that
stuff.
If it's not cooked, it's not going to attract.
That can stay on the top of the pile.
But if it was cooked broccoli and you had put butter on it, that's going to attract an animal.
What about tomatoes that are spoiling and stuff? Does that need to be buried?
I probably would do that just because of the smell.
Okay, but that doesn't have to be deep.
Same 16, 18 inches. If you have a pile, you just open the pile up, pour the stuff in, cover the pile back over.
Okay.
So how long should the compost pile, you know, be composting?
Well, usually if I start a compost pile, say in September, October, by the following spring, it could be ready if I was managing it well. The whole pile might not be broken down, but the part that's going to be ready first is down closest to the ground, because as that pile cools down, earthworms will move up and they start their business where they start processing materials.
We alluded to it, but the advantages of the compost pile.
Well, as we said, the advantages are it helps to helps the soil to hold moisture better. It does release some nutrients. When we taught a master composter class, we always used to analyze a number of compost samples. And it varied wildly, but usually you won't have more than 2 or 3% nutrients, so you can't consider it a fertilizer. It's a soil amendment, but it does supply some nutrients to the plants. Overall, the plants will be healthier if you use compost. You won't believe how much better plants grow when they've been exposed to compost.
Do you have to mix it to blend it, or can it be used straight when you put it on your garden, your compost?
Oh, what you could do is when it's ready in the spring, for instance, just put it on the surface before you till, just till it in. And it doesn't have to be totally broken down before you do that. The time that you want to use totally broken down compost is, what I've done is I'll take compost and I'll screen it, and then I'll use it as an amendment to a potting soil when I'm starting seedlings.
Okay.
And so, for instance, I might mix up to 50% compost in that, and the seedlings will do just fine.
So you're using your own material and not buying?
I'm buying some, but I'm mixing in compost so that I can stretch the potting mixture.
So is there a way you can speed up the process? I mean, it's best it takes a little longer. You should start in the fall, but I don't know.
Well, that's what we were talking about when we talk about the particle size. If it's chopped up, that helps. Maintaining a moist compost pile, a minimum size of the 3x3x3, the carbon to nitrogen ratio, all those things will speed up the process. If the pile gets too dry, it slows down. If there's too much nitrogen, too much carbon, it slows down. So they've done a lot of research on composting, on how to get the bacteria to be most efficient.
So you literally water your compost pile.
Yeah, and a lot of times people will tell you in some of the references that when you moisten your compost pile and you grab some of it and you squeeze it, water shouldn't fall out. It should be moist but not wet. But we found from some of the research that we were doing, when we start those piles, we just soak them down. And I don't advocate watering a compost pile, but if it gets really dry and you want the compost faster, then you should add some water to keep it moist.
Well, okay, so you have this compost pile outside, right?
Mm-hmm. It's going to get wet.
Yes, it is going to get wet, and that's what you want.
Okay, but you don't think it's not best to add water unless it's getting very dry?
Well, we have times of the year when you have a compost pile and it's very dry. So those are the times, if you want to speed that up, that's when you water it.
So when you water your lawn, you water your compost pile?
You can if it needs it. What I normally would do is, if I'm turning the pile and I notice it's dry on the inside, I'll take a hose and wet it while I'm turning it.
So when you're turning it, I'm thinking like of a pitchfork of turning, you got to...
Right.
Something.
And what I
stir it up.
I had a real simple system where I just took pallets, and I had a series of pallets that had three areas. So when I turned a pile, I turned it from one group of pallets to the next.
So, I mean, do you fork it over to the next pile?
Next bin, and then that leaves me open to start a whole new pile in the first bin.
Okay.
And so by the time it gets to the third bin, it stays there until it's finished.
Is it hard to get it? You leave one side open?
Yeah.
Okay. Uh-huh.
It's closed in three sides.
Okay.
Okay.
And you can have, you know, five of them together if you wanted.
There's a pallet. There's a fence place up for me, and they put out pallets, and so I'm going to start.
You want the heavy-duty ones if you want them to last.
Okay.
Sometimes they'll give you the heavy-duty ones. Other times they save those.
Okay.
And this using a compost on your garden is very good for the fertilizer.
Well, you get some nutrients, but it's not like putting on a fertilizer. It helps you to use the fertility better. And I had an extreme example of a farmer that it was a small organic farmer that had so much organic matter in his soil that he put on no fertilizer.
Mm.
And he was having some problems with plants setting fruit, because the soil was so rich that plants were getting huge, but they weren't producing things. So you can overdo it, but most people never will get to that point. It took him 30 years to get there.
Okay. All right. Well, folks, it's time to take a quick break, but stay tuned. We have more with the Garden Guy coming up.
Do you want an easy way to support Strong Tar Radio and it won't cost you anything? If you shop Amazon, you can set up your account to have them donate to us. Just go to smile.amazon.com and pick Strong Tower Radio as your charitable organization, and they will donate 0.5% of the eligible purchase to us. That's smile.amazon.com. And you can do more to support Strong Tower Radio by going to strongtowerradio.org and hit the donate button and become a monthly covenant partner. Remember, every little bit helps. We should do all in our power to spread the three angels' messages of Revelation 14, 6 through 12.
Hi, folks. I'm Jelaine Fenner, and welcome back to Strong Tower Radio today with my co-host,
Tom Majeure.
And this is the Garden Guy with Gary Heilig.
Hello.
And we've been talking about October. We talked quite a whole segment regarding composting.
I think we really did the dirt on that.
Yeah.
Well, I used to teach a class for extension. It was 5 weeks long.
Wow.
On composting. So wow. Do you have anything on your YouTube channel about composting where they can watch?
Not a whole lot. Eventually we'll put that entire class up there. But,
okay.
You know, it takes time to get all these things made.
All right.
We're looking forward to it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But we're here in October. sure.
Right. You know, cleaning up our garden. So let's talk about overwintering plants.
Yeah, and what I was talking about there, a lot of times people will buy things that aren't hardy in their environment. For instance, I bought some banana plants last year.
From Michigan?
Well, they're supposed to be hardy. We had the polar vortex, as you well know, and it fried them. So I said, okay, I want to give these guys a real test. And so this year, what I'm going to do is leave one in the ground, but I'm going to cover it over with a lot of mulch to give it a little insulation. And it's close to the house, so the house should have given it some heat. Mm-hmm. But I also have one in a pot that I will overwinter. I'll take that inside. But there are a number of other plants that they won't survive our winter, but you can keep them over the winter if you have the right conditions. For instance, we have an underground garage where the temperature doesn't get quite as cold as outside. So I can bring a lot of these plants in there, and it'll be warm enough for them not to grow, or I should say cold enough so that they won't grow, but warm enough so that they won't die.
So it almost sounds like you're researching or experimenting.
Oh, I'm always experimenting on something. But it's not unusual to do that, because at MSU, you'll see all these exotic plants growing, and some of them are quite large. Well, they'll keep a lot of these things in the greenhouse, or they'll store them in coolers until the next year, and then they'll put them back in pots.
Now, okay, you're bringing up about pots. That's going to keep a plant smaller in a pot than if it's actually in the ground. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay. You put something in the ground, it can grow quite big, depending on what it is and depending on what the year is like.
Can you switch them in and out, that third method of putting them in a pot and bring them in the garage? Can you do that every year? Annually?
Yeah, you could do it annually if you have the location where you can keep something. Some people might bring them down into the basement, but the problem with the basements are they're too warm and they'll continue to grow. So that means you're going to have lights down there, which I have lights in my basement for some things. I didn't even take out one of my plants this year, a philodendron, because it's just so big. And I just didn't want to move it.
So what happens when it gets too big?
Well, it sounds like it was pretty big.
When I took it in last year, in the pot and everything, it came up to my neck. So the leaves were probably 2 feet across, and wow, they would get even larger if it had been outside this year.
Mm-hmm. You had to contain it by keeping it indoors.
Yeah, and it may not be able to do anything with it after a while.
Now, when you're talking about your garage underground, does it freeze in there, or it's just like not quite freezing?
It can freeze, but see, what I can do is open the door into the main part of the garage, and I can move air into that and adjust the temperature the way I want it.
So you're monitoring.
Oh, yeah. I can monitor it.
Don't leave the garage door open for extended periods of time.
No. And we're going to put an insulated door on there, which will keep it even better for storing plants. It's a great place to store bulbs. When you're trying to get them to go through the period of time for forcing. If you've ever seen daffodils and tulips and things in the store in pots, well, normally what they do is they will store those at 40 degrees for about 14 weeks, and that's enough chilling for them to grow and flower. Mm-hmm. So I have ideal conditions for doing that type of thing.
So you're using all of your resources.
Oh, yeah. It's a great place to do that. So
what about, you know, protecting, though, your landscape during the winter from the deer? I mean, we've had, especially when it's a bad winter at the lake there, that the deer, you know, they can walk across the lake. They're starving, and they're coming up, and they're eating shrubs.
Yeah, because if the snow is deep, they can't find food as easily. And a lot of the plants that people put in their landscape are just great for the deer. And so they come and browse. And, of course, they don't know it belongs to somebody else. All they know is they're hungry and here's food. So there are some things that you can do to discourage them. The biggest thing is a physical barrier.
Okay.
There are some repellents that you can spray on certain plants, but they may require multiple applications, and people don't really like doing that too often. And there is a homemade version of some of these things that you can make. And I have tried one of these on my fruit trees, and it works pretty well. And basically what it is you take a milk jug and you put an egg in it that's been mixed with some water and blended. And then you fill the rest of the milk jug up with water, and you can put about a tablespoon of oil in there, which helps it to stick. You could just use a spreader sticker in it also, which you can buy at a garden center. And you can apply it as it is, or you can let it ripen a little bit. And you spray it on your shrubs during the winter, and it will repel deer from.
Really?
Yeah, it will repel them for about a month.
An egg.
Yeah, an egg. Oh. And if you look at some of the commercial products, they are putrescent eggs, which is basically rotten eggs. Hmm. And so it keeps the deer off. But the most effective thing is having a barrier. And in some cases, a barrier is not practical because it makes the landscape look bad with all these cages around things. But any young fruit tree, toward the end of the season, what I do is I build a complete cage around it so that the deer can't get to it.
Well, you want to protect it. That's right, so they don't ruin it.
And to give you an example of what happens when you don't do it, I had replaced some apple trees in my orchard, and the deer browsed it for 5 years, and the tree really never grew. Mm-hmm. And then I put a cage around it, a fairly large one, about 5 feet across. And within 1 year, the tree just took off. So the deer had kept that tree from doing anything. And after 5 years, I should have been getting a crop.
Yeah.
When I didn't even have much of a tree.
And what about berry bushes and things like that?
They will browse on raspberries. They'll browse on blueberries. Strawberries, you don't really have to worry about. And any young fruit tree, they'll feed on.
So I have a question. So then I see sometimes, you know, in the winter, the fall, getting winter, and people have like burlap wrapped around their shrubs. Is that one of the reasons to keep the deer from eating them?
It might help, but a lot of times burlap will be wrapped around shrubs to keep salt off of them. You see that a lot of times when a shrub is close to a street that gets salted. So when cars drive by, they throw the slush up on the plants.
Okay.
And what salt will do when it gets on the leaves of an evergreen is it actually will draw moisture out of that plant. And then the plant just dries. You see that along
the freeway.
Not only streets. Freeway, but also on people's sidewalks and their lawn. You'll see where they've been putting down the salt, and in the spring you'll see this line of grass is brown.
Mm-hmm.
That's because the salt has drawn the water out of those plants. And then those plants are dead, and then the remaining grass grows back in there.
Okay. Well, and the wintertime is always a good time about maintaining your equipment.
Yeah, as we were talking before we got started, in the spring, there are many, many things to do. Your lawn's starting to grow. You're trying to get your vegetable garden in. You're trying to deal with the fruit trees and the flowers and all the rest. There's just too many things to do. But equipment needs maintenance. And in the fall, just before it gets too cold in the garage, it's a good time to change the oil, change the filter. If you need to put new blades on the mower deck, get those things done. Sharpen your pruning tools. If you have a rototiller, you might want to do the same types of things, but check the tines to see if they need to be changed, because over the years of repeated work, those tines get very sharp and become less effective. So you
want the tines to be sharp? I would think they cut through the soil better.
No, what they do, the tines, I have a tri-built tiller, and the tines are shaped kind of like at the ends, like a rectangle. But as time goes on, they get sharpened to a point. So you've lost a lot of the surface area of the tine itself, which makes it less effective. And I'm at the point now where I really need to change my tines.
Going back to your barrier, well, you might, as far as equipment, you might get your blades on clearance. And so maybe it'd be Good time to buy your blades?
It depends on where, you know, for instance, I have a John Deere mower and...
They never go on sale?
No, they don't. But you will find, depending on what model you have, you might find those blades at some of the local box stores like the Home Depot and Lowe's for less.
Okay.
And they'll fit your mower.
What about stepping back to physical barriers? Could you give us a description of what a physical barrier would be? Would it be a wire fence with a certain size between the wires, or would it be wooden, or what might be your barrier?
Well, when I'm talking about barriers, for instance, if you have ewes, which deer love to feed on, then you might put up a fence of hardware cloth. Are you familiar with what hardware cloth
is? Explain it for me.
It's a metal fencing or barrier that the individual sections are about a half inch square. So there's no way a deer could get through that. A field mouse couldn't even squeeze through that. So you could get by with something a little bigger, but it has to be a barrier that will keep out what you're trying to keep out. And a deer, his nose will fit through something that is, say, 2 inch by 2 inches, and they can do some feeding. So you'd want something small enough or have the barrier far enough away from the protected plant so that an animal can't reach in between and feed on it.
You mentioned small enough for mice. Is mice an issue?
Mice can be an issue on certain things, like field mice will feed on fruit tree bark when it's smooth and young.
Okay.
Once it starts to harden up and become thicker, then you don't have to worry about that. So people will put on these plastic cages,
right,
or plastic wraps around the trunk, and those should be put on before the snow falls. And depending on how deep the snow gets, you should use maybe at least a 3-foot one. And realize that if the snow gets above where your protection is, you need to go clear that snow out, because when the snow gets packed down, rabbits will stand on top of it, mm-hmm, and feed up very high in the tree. And once they've done the damage, there's nothing you can do about it. But field mice can girdle a tree, a young tree, all the way around, and it'll die.
So are we, what about bushes?
Usually bushes are mature enough when you buy them that you don't have that problem. Bushes usually need to be protected from deer more than anything else.
Okay, Gary, so what are some other things we need to think about doing in October?
Well, one of the things I would get calls about is all the leaves that are falling, is it okay to mow them into the lawn? And the answer to that is yes, it's okay. MSU did some research one year to find out if it was any improvements to the lawn or detriment to the lawn in doing that, and they found out that it was no problem at all. The only limiting factor is how deep are the leaves and whether you can cut them up. And what I normally would do, instead of raking leaves, I would start cutting and I would just keep pushing them to the right. And you can break up the leaves even more by putting on what we call mulching mower blades, which tend to lift the material up and cut it multiple times before it discharges it. And then once I couldn't push it any further, then I would rake that material up and then put it in my compost pile. But it saved a lot of time in terms of having to rake things up. Also, if you have an in-ground irrigation system that you use to water your lawn, before you start getting freezing temperatures, you want to blow those lines out. You don't want water left in those lines. Otherwise, of course, when water expands, it can break the tubing, which is plastic below ground.
Can you do that yourself, or do you need to have a professional do that?
Either way. I mean, if you have an air compressor, you can do it yourself.
I just bought one this year, so.
Yeah.
A first.
You're going to learn how.
That's right.
Then the other thing is there might be some pruning that you can do on ornamentals. For instance, if you've had some sections of trees die, you can do that pruning before winter gets started, because if you have to get on ladders, it becomes more slippery when it's cold and wet and icy. So get those things done. And then, of course, as we run out of things to do outside, then we can start moving inside. There's lots of toys and things that you can play with indoors.
So what might those be?
Well, I love to propagate things. And my wife has African violets, for instance, and she really liked them. And just from one leaf of an African violet, I could produce hundreds of plants.
Really?
Is that what propagate means?
That's what, yeah, you're multiplying the plants. See, plants are different than people. They have two options of reproducing. We only have one option. Whereas plants, they can vegetatively reproduce. It would be the equivalent of me cutting off a finger, putting it in the ground, and a whole new me would grow. I don't think very many people would want to see that. But anyway, so those African violets, I can cut off a single leaf and treat the petiole, which is the part where the leaf blade is attached, and I can treat that with a hormone, and it will start to produce at first roots, and then it'll start to produce all new African violets right there where I propagated the plant and put the leaf in the ground. And I can literally get hundreds of plants from that one single leaf. And I have another situation where I need to move a lilac. It's a French lilac, and two trees are kind of crowding it out, and it's not blooming as well. And I can take what's called hardwood cuttings, which are the kind of cuttings you would get once the wood from the new growth has gotten hard. Or if I would have gotten to it in June, I could take softwood cuttings and then propagate those and start a whole bunch of new lilacs. So you can grow these things indoors under lights during the winter months. And then if it's something that goes outside, you can put them outside and grow them up to their full size.
You have to do that before the lilac becomes dormant, correct?
Well, once it becomes dormant, you can still take cuttings. Those are called the hardwood cuttings. But softwood cuttings are from new growth from various ornamentals.
So when we start under grow light in February or whatever, could I take a cutting from my lilac outdoors then and do that with all my other grow lights?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you could.
Plants?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is there any limitation? Is it almost across the board? You can anything you want?
Plants you can do that. Now, trees are a little bit more difficult to do.
Now, you're not going to do this with your vegetable plants?
No.
Okay.
I'm glad I asked. I probably would have done it.
I'm going to be starting some vegetable plants in the next few weeks, but they will be to test those things I was telling you about, like adding silica and biochar and some of these things to see how they grow.
Well, you'll have to report back to us and let us know.
We'll have to save something for next month.
Yeah.
Okay, folks. Well, our time has run out like it always does. And you've been listening to Strongtown Radio today with Gary Heilig, the garden guy, and Tom's favorite program.
That's right. Yep.
And so tune in next month when Gary will be back and we will talk more about gardening in November.
Bye, folks.